Emily Sekine.
What do you do?
What do I do? Currently I work as a freelance editor and writer and sort of a freelance anthropologist, I suppose.
Who do you freelance with? Like, what does that mean?
Well, for this project, I'm kind of acting as a freelance anthropologist. Researcher, I guess. I finished my PhD last year, and so since then I've been just freelancing. But yeah, most of my work is editing, so a lot of academic works, books and articles for people, and writing, getting more into trying to do writing, like publishing in magazines and such.
How did you get, yeah, we didn't talk about Japan, but how did you get involved in the whole scene, the program?
The curriculum. I did my fieldwork in Japan, and some of the people that I knew were also going to this symposium that was being hosted by the Research Institute for Humanity and Nature in Kyoto. And it was sort of, I'm not exactly sure what Hakabe's role was. I think they were kind of co-hosting or co-producing this symposium in Japan. And I think it was the first one that they'd done in Japan. So it was, I think, trying to extend their work in Asia, and this was part of a conference called, I think, the Anthropocene on the Ground, something about that, looking at Asian experiences of nature in all of their diversity and trying to see what they had to say about the Anthropocene, basically, and the relevance of that concept in various settings across Asia. So I was asked to give a talk at that symposium, and they had organized several events, and like I think a lot of these things, like very intense days of, you know, organized talks and events. We went to a Buddhist temple in Kyoto where they did a kind of talk with an artist who was installing a piece in a Japanese garden there, which is quite interesting. So yeah, and I heard about the river project when I was there, and they invited me to be one of the travelers.
So are you kind of also sort of reflecting on this process, and how, like, are you, how do you feel? How do you feel your role as a freelance anthropologist on the project plays out? Like, what do you?
Well, the project. So they ask us to propose projects. So my contribution is going to be what I was calling a field diary of the Upper Mississippi. Basically a way to, because I'm not very familiar with this area and I don't have a lot of the attachments that other people have coming to this project where, you know, they've already been working with communities or with the landscape here, and that's not the case for me. So I think I wanted to just be in a position where I could have something very open-ended and yet that still had some kind of structure. So I was going to choose several objects along the way, and also sort of play with the idea of these explorers coming down the river and, you know, critique that idea a little bit of what we're doing here.
Have you chosen those objects yet?
I've been collecting in a way, but I'm not sure yet which ones I'm going to write about. I think I like the idea of selecting sort of rogue objects that aren't easy to catalog or classify, especially objects that are produced by many different types of human and non-human forces, or that are sort of out of place for where people expect them to be. So one of the objects that I was thinking of focusing on was this red buoy, one of the nun buoys that got that are used to mark the navigational channel, the 9-foot channel. But it had kind of got loose from its spot where it was supposed to be and traveled into the backwaters that we discovered one day when we went canoeing around Richmond Island in Minnesota. And it just was sort of this, they call them nun buoys, which is also very kind of evocative. So it's very easy to like anthropomorphize them. But just seeing this buoy stuck in the backwaters, I liked that idea. And then Joe was talking about how when he's seen the Army Corps of Engineers boats kind of going along the river and repositioning the buoys in their proper spots. But of course they travel all the time and they're always kind of getting out of line. And so this ongoing work of engineering the river is interesting to me. So I think, yeah, writing, choosing like the buoy, and then I would have some sort of photograph of it. For some objects, I'm hoping to actually collect the physical object, but I also don't want to disrupt anything or be too extractive. So I'm still working out what my process is for that.
You mentioned that it was a kind of critique of what we're doing here, so to speak. What's the nature of that? Like, is it just about, I don't know, how to not make it Anthropocene tourism?
Yeah, I think the extractive nature of knowledge in this area, right? This history of kind of expeditions and exploring, not just here, but, you know, all over the place. And then that effort to categorize and catalog and put names on everything and to organize them into something coherent when there's, you know, things don't stay in those categories and they aren't that intelligible and there's multiple ontologies for everything. So I think, yeah, just trying to figure out a way to tell some of those stories and explore the tensions around how to name and how to understand and know the landscape, but through these particular objects that maybe feel very mundane, but actually are, you know, sort of have layers and layers of stories to them. So yeah, I'm not sure what other objects I'm going to choose. There's a very interesting beaver sculpture, that's what we've been calling it, that we found in Bedote, the area around the confluence of the Missouri and the Mississippi. The beaver sculpture. So it's it was like an area where we could see that beavers had been working because there was a lot of trees that had been sort of half chewed. And this one, normally when you find something that a beaver has chewed, one end is, you know, chewed down to a point, but the other isn't, right? Because they just do one side in order to fell the tree. But this one was chewed on both sides. And so we were describing it as like a very inventive beaver who had created this unuseful sculpture. So thinking about beavers as engineering the river as well and doing having their own sort of projects that they're enacting that you know complicate or run against what the Corps of Engineers is doing to the river, I think might be another thing that I'd like to write about. But I don't know that much about beavers, so I'm on the lookout for signs of them all the time, but we haven't, so far we've seen one beaver lodge, but no actual beavers, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Incredibly fascinating creatures.
Yeah.
I'm actually sort of, some story in my head, Canadians have lots of stories about beavers, obviously, and there's a story in my head about anxiety in beavers causing this kind of behavior.
Anxiety? do you, like, the, oh, that makes them...
They overbite when they're, like, being in control and stuff, and they do weird things, like, try to take down trees that are too big for them, and,
okay.
And bite all sides of the tree.
What is it that's causing them anxiety, according to these?
Just human encroachment.
Human encroachment.
Different kinds of encounters. Yeah. Well... really very, like, because they're familial and they're social.
Very neurotic seeming, some, right? Yeah.
They seem neurotic, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this, the image of beavers is very interesting. Like, these industrious, type A, controlling architects.
Gotta get up and go to work.
Yeah. Always working. So.
You're working in the upper Mississippi. This is the kind of idea, right? Like,
yeah. I mean, that was just a sort of practical demarcation because that's how long I'm on the trip for. So it really wasn't that thought out. Just using that term, but probably would be a good thing to think about why that, what that term means. Yeah, I haven't quite decided how much of myself I want to put into it. I don't know, do you know about, like, Bronislaw Malinowski's work in the Trobriand Islands? He was one of the first, he's considered to be sort of the founder of anthropology, especially ethnographic anthropology, ethnography as a method, I should say. And he was Polish, but he spent most of his famous work was done in the Trobriand Islands in Polynesia area, and he had he wrote in three languages. I think he would write his field notes for the day in the language that the natives spoke, and then he wrote his personal diary in Polish, where he would write all of his complaints about the natives and about how miserable he was, basically. And then he would write up his research findings in English. And for years, like, his personal diary was kept private and unpublished, and then it kind of came out in the 1960s, and it was published for the first time under, I think, the title of A Diary in the Strict Sense of the Term. And so it was very controversial when it came out, and it was kind of coinciding with all of these wider debates in anthropology of, like, around the politics of representation and trying to critique, you know, our colonial legacy as anthropologists, in both, you know, direct and indirect ways. I was partly kind of thinking about that as well, this idea of a diary and the separation of, you know, our personal experience of doing field work and then what makes it into our published accounts and all of this, you know, all of these questions about objectivity and subjectivity and, I'm not sure yet quite what I want to say about it, but those are the things that were on my mind when I chose the word diary.
What's a diary in the strictest sense?
I think for him it meant like a private, personal, honest account that he didn't want to share with anyone.
It'd be great if you did the whole project and didn't do anything with it.
With
if you did this whole diary and
just kept it to myself. Yeah, that would be great.
No, it's a diary, you're not allowed to read it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's private. I could just post a photo of like my locked diary with a
that'd be awesome.
Yeah. One of those old fashioned locks on it.
Like a little 16-year-old.
Yeah. But it is something that I think anthropologists think about a lot because our field notes are very private. I think that most people would be like horrified for their raw field notes to be read by anyone. Whether because it is including all of these sort of personal details and complaints, and especially in a situation like this where you're possibly writing about other people on the trip that you want to complain about, or about, you know, your frustration with the food or the bathroom situation or whatever it is, right? There's all sorts of these daily, mundane parts of life that are probably not going to make it into most of the accounts and the contributions that come out of this project. And so, yeah, this has been like, this is something that about ethnographic fieldwork that has always really fascinated me. There's another Michael Taussig, the anthropologist.
I'm just going to bring up that book, I swear I saw that.
Yeah, that's, yeah. There's that one, which I've only read part of that, but there's another one that he published, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, I think, called The Color, What Color is the Sacred, right? Where he, I think he's talking about Malinowski in that book. Where there's a particular section where Malinowski is describing in his diary something about like the beautiful colors of the landscape, and it's his personal reflection on the beauty of this place. But then when he writes it up in English, like to publish it, it's about what the natives see. So it's like he kind of projects, you know, his own experience onto, says that it's, yeah, something that they experience. So there's this, you know, it's a lot of questions around what we understand as knowledge of a place, I think. So trying to be careful about that, and yeah. You mean how the project itself is describing the place?
Yeah.
Like the language that Hakabe is using, for
not
example?
Not just the language, but the whole translation between, I mean, perhaps not so much has come out yet, really, on the other side, but, mm-hmm. So maybe it's too early to tell, because not so much has been published.
Right.
It's one of the things I think we're concerned about. Like, mm-hmm. It's a strange project overall, in the sense of you mentioned.
Yeah.
Incursion of like voyages and mm-hmm. stuff that the Germans are here, you know.
Yeah.
A joke that they keep making about how they're so parochial. Like,
right.
But it doesn't forgive it just because you're making jokes all the time.
Right. And yeah. I think what I've been thinking about more, I mean, that's all there as well, but more the speed at which we're meant to do this project. And then also the kind of what feels to me just like an overdetermined nature of a lot of the projects that, for me, like going into a place and doing fieldwork, it takes a lot of time. You really need to like give yourself space and time to understand a place and its complexities. Whereas I feel like people have already have these very, very kind of determine projects about what they want to say about the place, and they're going in and looking for evidence of that. rather than sort of letting the project emerge from actually engaging with the landscape or the communities around, which to me is just a very strange way to go about it. And I think what I was, it's not necessarily a critique, but I just, because I know that some people are, they do live here and they have engaged with the landscape, and so they are, they've already thought about all of these questions a lot, right? And so they're positioned very differently. But for me, as someone coming along on the trip, I find it really hard to kind of say anything descriptive or interpretive about the place without knowing it that well. So yeah, that's a little bit uncomfortable, I guess.
It's a nice overdetermination. Engineered river, for example, as a framing is always there. Mm-hmm. And then even the beaver thing fucks that up a little bit, which is nice.
Yeah.
there's also other things engineering the river.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, the whole concept of the Anthropocene itself, right, it already determines, it's a way of describing the landscape that's very overdetermined, because you're looking for evidence of human shaping of the landscape, and we kind of forget about all these other processes that are going on. And that's been really interesting, to be out on the river itself, seeing how much power the river itself has to shape the landscape as well, which I feel like gets under thought about in a lot of these, the ways that the project's being framed.
That it's kind of an unruly,
yeah,
up in the Itasca field station, whatever that was, zero, which was that, I forget, it must have been Joe, actually, we were having another one of these, it was exactly this, mm-hmm. not in a car, and he was like, yeah, the river's sort of like this organizing principle, but it's also a disorganizing principle, like, every once in a while it also just thwarts what you think it's going to do.
Yeah, that's very interesting. That was something that I thought about a lot in my dissertation research in Japan, because I was thinking about geological processes, which are not very subject to human intervention, right? They, humans can, I guess, with fracking, cause an earthquake now, but for the most part, geological processes remain like completely outside of the realm of our control. And so they're an interesting, I think, force to think about in relation to the Anthropocene, because they are not, they don't fit that well, actually, into that framework of thinking about humans as this kind of overwhelming force that's changing the planet. Like, there's still these much bigger forces that are, you know, ancient forces that are acting upon us as well. So, trying to, like, I always try to give some space for that.
Have I just cut you off?
No.
I'm interested how the Anthropocene was talked about in Japan, because the people I've spoken mm-hmm. to about it here is that, in fact, a lot of this work is about dismantling and undoing some of the potency that the term has mm-hmm. acquired, which indeed projects like this tend to affirm and accelerate. But how is it received in Japan? How's it thought about in comparison, I suppose, to
it's interesting, because I think there is, so within the humanities, my sense, like very, very, you know, rough, broadly writ, that a lot of like what scholars who are interested in the Anthropocene are, they're deploying that term in order to make this argument about how humans are entangled with nature. Right, like humans and non-human forces are entangled in all of these ways, and we, because of our categories, have too long separated nature and culture. And so it's, you know, it's trying to undo that philosophical tradition that has separated out humans from nature. Whereas in like Japan, for example, that's never been taken for granted as a philosophical, you know, underpinning. And so people are like, well, sure, of course they're connected, right? It's not a, it doesn't have the same, I don't know, insight that, you know, that it does, I think, in Euro-American intellectual settings. So, yeah, that, it was an interesting combination of people there trying to kind of speak to one another. I think, yeah, trying to kind of, the basic idea was to, for one thing, bring a humanities perspective into a institution that has been very natural science based, the Research Institute for Humanity and Nature. So I think for that was more the trouble that people were having, was kind of talking across that natural science and humanities divide in that particular setting.
One of the conversations we had when I was touring around with Latour in China was, he was like talking about this in terms of the separation of language and, you know, like the word and the thing. Again, a kind of completely non-starter in China. Like,
right. Like, yeah, that's that they already know that they're connected.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's... there's also a lot more emphasis in Japan on disaster, like what our, what quote-unquote, right, our experience of nature and of disaster in Japan can teach the rest of the world. So that kind of... this sense that, like, we've already been dealing with a lot of climatological and geological unruliness just based on where Japan is on the planet. So that's kind of like an exportable, seen as like an exportable knowledge that they have. So there was a lot of that talk, like addressing the, trying to understand how Japanese experiences of disaster could inform preparedness. So very practical, like, approach to the Anthropocene in that sense. But it was kind of all over the place. I do think it was very East Asian focused in Japan, whereas I think that they're trying to get at the multiplicity of Asian experiences of nature, quote-unquote. but I don't know if that quite happened at this particular symposium.
Well,
just to quickly ask about the current thing you're on, the choice to, like, take some weeks out of your life and get on a boat.
Yeah.
It's kind of an extreme thing to do.
Yeah.
It's not quite as extreme as doing the entire trip, which I also find. And it's not that many people who are going to do the whole thing, which is also fascinating. Like, I thought it was more.
Yeah.
And it's actually like Nell, Andrew, Nicole, and a couple of the students.
Yeah, Stephen and Audrey. And then John Kim is doing most of it.
Right.
Most of the trip.
So anyway, that, sorry, back to you. Like, what? I guess there's two questions. Why would you do that to yourself? Like, kind of more general, like, reflection on what you, what motivation you might have had to do that, and then also, like, what you might hope to get out of it, or, like, what you think the river might teach you.
I think I just wanted a adventure, personally. Like, something... Some, and also a different way of thinking about how to do research. I mean, I am very interested in the idea of, like, a collaborative research project, because my previous experiences have been fairly solitary in doing research. So I was very drawn to that idea of just working with other people and seeing what they see and how that could enrich or complicate or deepen my own understanding of a place. Really just kind of like along for the ride. Just pretty open-ended about what I wanted to get out of it. I am writing, I think, hopefully, some other pieces that might, outside of, you know, the Anthropocene curriculum website, I'm hoping to write a piece for some other places, other publications. So I guess looking for stories, inspiration. And I haven't done research in the US, really. So I think I've been wanting to find ways of engaging more deeply with my own home, as it were. I'm not that familiar with this area, but I grew up not too far from here, just like in Indiana, and I live in Pittsburgh now, which is part of the Mississippi watershed. So I think trying to get ideas for how to engage more deeply with where I am.
That's cool. I mean, that's wonderful. The interview, by the way, thank you. We're going to be on the record, off record, but I'm curious how you think about the relationship between, like, your academic work and, like, what you might just think of as, like, journalism or, you know, because also what we're doing is sort of this, I think, like, what involves some sort of a researcher with the artists and we're, it's like all these kind of hybrid
practices. Yeah. Yeah, partly, that's for sure. Yeah, I definitely am interested in kind of thinking about what it means to do public anthropology. Because there are a lot of anthropologists nowadays who aren't working formally in academic institutions. And I think a lot of us are really, have done interesting projects and also are trained to think about, to think really like holistically and across, you know, across many different systems and forces that are sort of shaping the possibilities and constraints of how we live. But we aren't good at translating that, those insights or that knowledge or experience into interesting, engaging forms of content. So yeah, that's, for me, that's like what I want to do, is to be some sort of intermediary there who's translating that type of anthropological knowledge into public content. Mostly through writing, but what?
It's a cool motivation. It's also something that sort of, like, I think about the anthropologization of the world somehow, like, because, you know, like, there's so much of this sensory anthropology stuff. Our worlds in the last couple of years have just been so obsessed with ethnography and anthropology.
I think as big data becomes so much more dominant, there's sort of this need for qualitative, situated knowledge production that you know, goes against sort of the trend within a lot of media today. Is so much more like black and white and, you know, easily consumed in 5 minutes.
It feels to me as
like long form investigative journalism is very, it's still important though, and there is still space for it, I think. You know, there you see different outlets that are still funding this type of work, but.
What do you think about people like Jacek? Like, is he a hero or is he kind of a bit of a, what's the impression of Jacek in
life? Jacek?
Or just somebody like him, because he was sort of this like somewhat aggressive, masculine, radical.
Yeah. People like him. Yeah, I think he's still appealing to a lot of people, the kind of work that he does and the role that he has within anthropology.
He's an old man now, he's like an
old man. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard, I mean, because I went to school at the New School, so he's sort of part of the New York anthropology scene. But I didn't personally know him or have that like any interactions with him. He's kind of really. I mean, I think he was kind of. Yeah, people were very interested in him and his, you know, his like shamanism and you know. Yeah, his way of being. Yeah, so.
The white t-shirts and the kind of scraggly.
Yeah.
Shows up the stuff looking like he just got off.
Yeah. Like a legendary figure, I would say. Yeah.
We're at 40 minutes.
Yeah, no, I didn't mean.